I learned to welcome the pain. And if it hurts too much, I'll pass out. Get your rest and you get up and you keep moving. Everest just costs a lot of money and it takes a lot of time. I was 61 and they were saying, wow, you're like the oldest guy on this team. What happened to me as climbing one of these ladders and I started developing hape and haste. When I put my head down, just fluid was coming out of my nose and mouth. And then I lost my memory, got to the top and I passed out. Really happy the whole thing happened. Because I would have rather something like that happen than going the whole rest of my life thinking, I wish I had tried it. I wish I could have done that.
Stories stir the soul.
Stories reveal.
And stories heal.
In this podcast, we will give you an inside look at someone who's had a life-changing breakthrough.
Real people, real stories with real breakthroughs. As a health and wellness expert and coach, and Todd as a men's mentor,
we've seen firsthand what God can do when it comes to a breakthrough. So lean in, listen well. This could be your biggest breakthrough.
Hello, and welcome to Your Biggest Breakthrough. I'm your host, Wendy Pett.
I'm Todd Isburner. So Wendy, we have got a show lined up today that is going to inspire. It's going to rock your world. I know we say that a lot, but this is going to be really different. But it reminds me of ways in which we push past, or maybe we don't push past certain limits. Like, have you ever found yourself really saying to yourself, you know, I've just pushed past some real limits on me?
I have, but not often enough, if I were to be honest.
Wait a minute. I don't mean like pushing past the limits of being married to me.
Oh, well, that's for sure.
No.
That is definitely a limit I push past.
But the reality is we stop, I think, because we don't maybe have the mindset or the disciplines or whatever it is, and we end up falling, you know, short.
Yeah, but on the show today, our guest is no stranger to pushing past limits, physically, mentally, spiritually, I would even say emotionally. But Don Mann is a former Navy SEAL. Team 6 operator.
So perk up. As soon as we say that, you've got your attention.
Tune in. Yeah. A world-class endurance athlete, another reason to tune in, and a New York Times best-selling author.
World-class athlete. I just got to say this. He was ranked 38th in the world on triathlons.
Yeah.
So, and you might recognize him from his TV series, Surviving Man. And this is where he challenges others to go beyond what they think is possible. It's fascinating. Wendy and I binged a little bit on it. You'll be so blown away and inspired by it. And Don's story is it's just packed with these high-stakes adventures, elite training, global impact. But even more powerful are the personal battles that he's faced, the loss of loved ones, supporting his family through illnesses. And then most recently, a family cancer diagnosis.
Yeah. And through it all, Don has stayed grounded in his faith, using every run, bike ride, and paddle as a time to pray. His life is a powerful example of how grit, grace, and purpose can transform hardship into breakthrough.
Oh, man, so good. You're going to be inspired by this man who's lived life to the extremes. He's found strength not just on the battlefield or the race courses, but strength for surrendering to something greater than himself.
Yeah, get ready to be encouraged. Enjoy the show. Well, welcome, Don Mann, to Your Biggest Breakthrough. We are delighted to have you.
Wendy and Todd, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Oh man, I tell you, we just finished your bio, and it's kind of like, where in the world do we start? You have done so much. In fact, you have such a full life of adventure and accomplishments. From being an endurance athlete, a SEAL Team 6 veteran,
and
a
one
trainer,
and two. SEAL Team 1 and 2 as well.
SEAL Team 1 and 2, and a mountaineer, and your stories about climbing mountains and attempting Everest. And you're a speaker, you're an author, God's given you a wonderful platform to help others. Now you're a TV show creator and host. And I mean, the list goes on and on. But as we were talking just before we started recording, we're grateful for the way you carry yourself and the humble attitude that you have. But I'm curious, Wendy and I were wondering, so like, when did you realize that you were made for something more than just average? Because you're not average. When did that occur to you? Like, okay, this, I'm going the distance on life.
Well, Wendy and Todd, for one, the things that I've done, I don't think they compare at all to what you're both doing to start with. I have to say that for sure.
God bless you.
But thanks. I think for me in the seventh grade is actually, I should go back to like second grade. We moved around a lot, but I'd always want to go out in the woods and try to go out as far as I can and turn around without getting lost. Then when I got a bicycle in fifth grade, I tried doing that in the towns. And then, but in seventh grade, my mother asked me what I wanted for Christmas. And I was thinking, whatever it is, I want to take my life in that direction. And it was either going to be weights to go toward sports or some recording device to go toward music. Those are my two passions. So I decided I probably don't have any talent at all, so I'd go toward sports. And then in seventh grade, I just never stopped working out and training for some goal. And so I always had some race. And I loved racing because the race on Sunday or the race at the end of the year or something kept me moving and training to reach that goal. And so for me, I had macro goals. And the way I picture a macro goal is me or anybody just standing at the ground, looking up, thinking, what can I do that's really, really, really big? And then set a whole series of micro goals to reach up to it. And most times that worked out. And people would say, how are you going to climb Everest? How are you going to be a SEAL? How can you do an Ironman? And because they seemed hard if you're just looking at the macro goal. But when you break it down into all the micro goals to reach up to it, they weren't that difficult. And so somehow I just lucked out thinking I wanted a life full of adventure and fitness. And I just kept setting the macro goals towards something adventurous or fitness related.
That is so applicable to everyday life. I mean, you don't have to think, well, I can't do that because I could never be a SEAL. Well, you could do what Don did, set a macro goal and then some micro goals to reach that macro goal. And I think that's a challenge that you never get too old for. But I'm fascinated that, you know, God sort of wired you that way at such a young age that you had those kind of ambitions and that drive to be able to go after these goals.
Well, and the foresight to see that you go micro to go macro. So many times people, like you said, they just see the macro and then they quit because it's too overwhelming.
There is one of the talks I did. It was for an elderly home. And I've done them for Christy Brinkley's little girls at her school and then at elderly homes too, and everybody in between. But this one, they asked me to do a talk at a home for retired judges and doctors. And they're all in the 80s and 90s. I was thinking, what am I going to say? But I gave them my talk and this little old lady came up and her husband was on a wheelchair and on oxygen. And she said, I really got a lot out of that talk. Now when I take my husband to his physical therapy, I'm going to push him harder. So, it does work for anybody.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I'm not so sure the husband became a fan of yours after that.
I don't know if he survived it after that.
But, you know, it is about the push. You know, you have competed in over 1,000 races, and they're not just, you know, little 5Ks. We're talking ultra races. And so I think about how you are number 38 globally as far as ranked as a triathlete. But what drives you to push so hard for so long? Like, is that just something that you're wired to push and to be driven that way? Or did you see this kind of work ethic with your parents? Like, kind of how, I don't know. I'm amazed. Like, I want a little more of that.
Mm-hmm. My parents are both hard workers and they both, you know, we grew up God, country, family. And they were the greatest generation. God comes first, country comes second, family comes third. And I never hear that anymore now that family comes third, but God comes first. And so my parents always instilled that in me, especially my father. And when we were attacked, you know, World War II and the Japanese attacked us, he was in high school. He quit high school and his two brothers quit and his sister quit and they all joined the military. And so my grandparents had 4 stars on their doorstep during that time frame. But whenever something came about, when it came with religion, or Christianity, or the military, my father would just freeze up and he would just get so, so emotional. Mm-hmm. And so he instilled that in us. And so I think that with the combination of the physical want I had, I think the combination of that made me want to drive hard. And you know, I picture the people when the Bataan Death March and the ones the Nazis got, and people who live in these poor countries and they don't have anything and they have to survive. All I've done was things I volunteered to do.
Right.
And they were recreational. It was just for fun and sports. So I always pictured, you know, I'm just doing this for fun. Yeah, they're challenging, they're hard, but look at all the millions of people in this world who have to live with hardships all the time. I chose for these hardships. And what helped me is I learned to welcome the pain. I felt anything worth doing is going to hurt. So bring it on. And if it hurts too much, I'll pass out. And passing out, you don't feel the pain anymore. You get your rest and you get up and you keep moving. And by learning that, I was never afraid to accept pain. Pain is something you need to get through the next hardship, I believe. So I think with my parents' influence, they were both hard workers. It was God, country, family. And then the physical drive combined that now I know I wanted to be a SEAL. And now I will know I want to do these tough competitions. And like, for instance, today I was up at 4 bike riding. And I just had a blast. Oh,
hey, man. I rolled out of bed and did some push-ups. Unreal. I was just talking about people that get up at 4 in the morning and work out, wasn't I?
Well, that you can't just lay that on Don as though he gets up at 4. Well, and here you go, getting up at 4, riding your bike. That's awesome.
Well, I have to say, Don, I think the majority of, you know, I'm going to stereotype, but the majority of people, especially in this country, get caught up in the pleasure trap. Like they just want to remain in that comfort zone and they're not willing to push themselves because of that pain. They think that pain is bad, but pain really does drive us to become better, more resilient people. And so I think about all of your races and all of your climbs, and I'm just curious if there are one or two stories that you could share from either a race or a climb, or maybe, I don't know, you can have so many stories, but one that comes to mind that maybe just kind of tipped you over the edge. Like, okay, I hit my pain threshold here.
Yeah, how you got through
it. How you got through it.
Well, maybe I can speak to the last thing that happened to me, where I'm very fortunate to have gotten through it, would be the Everest incident. And you know, Everest just costs a lot of money and it takes a lot of time to prepare for it and everything. But I climbed about 30 or so mountains preparing for it. And I finally had a 70-day time frame where I can leave for 70 days. You needed that commitment and you needed about $60,000. So finally, I was able to do that without mortgaging my house. But I was able to get all that done. And I was feeling really, really fit. And this was 7 years or so ago, 8 years maybe. And my team was so strong. Everybody was mainly the Kiwis, the New Zealanders. Nothing against Americans, but they make us look very soft as Americans. Yeah. I mean, you don't see overweight people over there. And you see everybody out running around and running in the mountains and just working out. And they're fit and they're happy. And they're not on the cell phone all day. And they're not just sitting on the couch watching TV, eating junk food. Yeah. And 2/3 of that country is not obese. It's opposite of that. So you see a lot of those people on Everest on these hard climbs. And Lydia Bradley was one of the folks we had. And she was the first woman to summit Everest without oxygen. And she summited 7 times.
Oh, amazing.
And Andre Dorje Sherpa, the most famous Sherpa in the world, was on our team. And he summited Everest more than anybody and saved more lives on Everest than anybody. So we had such a solid team. Wow. And they were saying, wow, you're like the oldest guy on this team. And there were about 12 of us. And this isn't bothering you at all. I said, well, knock on wood. No, I feel good.
So we want to know, how old were you?
Oh, wait. Can you do that? Yes, we do want to know.
Yeah, because if he's the oldest guy on the team, what does that mean?
And how many years ago was it?
7 years ago.
Okay, so I was 61.
Wow. 61. Oh. Amazing. Yeah.
The old guy.
61. Yeah, yeah, I was the old guy for sure. I didn't feel it though.
No.
For most of it. Right. After a while. But, and then, so So everything was going well. You know, we had some medevac situations where people on the team started collapsing and breaking and having to be lifted off the mountain. And but it was scary because there were a lot of avalanches. And it was supposed to be the worst year in Everest recorded history because of all the avalanches, because the snow is melting from the top of the mountains, coming down and creating all these avalanches. And the year before, everybody in base camp, a lot of them were killed through the avalanches. And some of the guys who weren't in their tent, three of them were on our team. And I came close friends with them. They'd show me pictures. I go, oh, my God, this is a picture of my tent. It was crushed. I happened to be out of it. My teammates were all killed, and they came back the year I did it just to try to do it again.
Wow.
And so it was emotional. So you had hypothermia and avalanches and crevasses and things that can go wrong. But the avalanches really kept you stressed because you heard them all day and all night, and you don't know when the next one's coming through. And you saw them. And one morning, I just remember a bunch of Sherpas trying to rush down the mountain, trying to outrun an avalanche. And and when you're laying in your tent at night and you hear them, you didn't know if your tent was going to be crushed. And that year, I was called by a Discovery TV show saying, hey, we heard you're going out there. We know it's going to be a bad year. Last year was the worst ever. The year before was the second worst. But this one, we're expecting it to be the worst of all time because of the avalanches. Could you help us out with some rescues? Because when I was a SEAL, I was really involved in medevac, combat medics, and things work like that. So I said, absolutely. If I can, I'll be there to help. They ended up rescuing me. But what happened is you can get high altitude pulmonary edema where your lungs fill with fluid, and you can get high altitude cerebral edema where the space in your brain between your brain cavity and your skull, that space fills with fluid. And they don't know why it happens yet. It's not age or physical fitness or anything. They don't know why HAPE and HACE occur. But we lost some people with both on our team. And I'm still feeling fine. But there's these ladders you have to climb. They're 16-foot aluminum ladders. And sometimes they tie them together and you have these long, long vertical climbs or going across a crevasse. Where if you look down, it's like the center of the earth, and they wobble and shake. And it's the scariest part on Everest. It's where it's most dangerous place on Everest. But what happened to me as climbing one of these ladders, and I started developing HAPE and HACE, like it just came on me like a ton of bricks. When I put my head down, just fluid was coming out of my nose and mouth, and I couldn't catch my breath, and it sounded like a fish tank when I take a breath. It sounded like so much gurgling. And then it got dark, and then I lost my memory. It didn't really get dark. I lost my vision, my color vision, because the fluid was pressing on part of my brain where it affects your vision and your memory. And I was going up a vertical ladder at that time, and then I looked down, and those fluids would come out, and then I was on the ladder thinking, where am I? And everything was getting – I didn't know where or what I was doing, but I knew to climb the ladder. And the ladder didn't reach all the way to the top of the ice wall. So you have an ice pick and you put it in and you pull yourself up. And I had this big heavy coat on, a summit jacket. And then I got to the top and I passed out. And when I opened my eyes, Andre Dorje Sherpa, the most famous Sherpa in the world, was looking down at me like you couldn't have a better person looking down at you at that point. He saved so many lives up there. He asked me if I could walk. I said, yeah. But I couldn't speak because I was just gurgling and frothing at the mouth, basically. And he gave me his oxygen mask. And I put my hands on the back of his shoulders and we're walking. But I kept passing out because I couldn't breathe. And then we got to this like 200-foot ice wall. And he said, can you rappel? I wanted to say, I've rappelled all my life. Of course I can rappel. But I couldn't speak. So I just shook my head. And he went down. And then I had my harness on, my rappel device, and I tucked the rope and I looked down and I was thinking, I forgot how to rappel because I lost my memory. Wow. But that morning I saw some Sherpas and they wrapped the rope around their arm 8 or 9 times and they just went down off the ice cliff, just releasing one loop at a time. And I remembered that. So I thought I would try that. I was the only one there and I didn't know that's the only thing I knew to do. So I just wrapped the rope around my arm a bunch of times and I saw Andre down there and I just released one loop at a time thank God I had enough loops there because I made it to the ground. Okay. And finally made it back down to base camp, which is still over 20,000 feet and still hard to breathe and everything. And our doctor was medevac. So we didn't have a doctor and our team was getting smaller and smaller. And I didn't want to be around everybody because I was just coughing and choking and people need sleep there. And I hated being the one. I didn't know how sick I was. I just knew I was coughing and choking. And so they went and found a doctor, and that doctor was probably if I could pick a doctor in this world to treat me, it would be her, because she was well known because the avalanche the year before, she was hit with a piece of ice in her thigh, and she sewed up her own thigh and went on saving lives. They found her, and she came and she listened to my lungs, and she was down. Oh boy. And she was having other people come listen because it was the worst she heard with HAPE, the high-altitude pulmonary edema. And she said, we got to get you off the mountain today or bad things are going to happen. But the medevac couldn't come in because a storm was there. And so I couldn't get off the mountain. But because my brain was in the condition it was, I didn't realize how bad it was. So I call it knocking on heaven's door, Bob Dylan song. Yeah. But I was pretty close. And I just really happy the whole thing happened because I would have rather something like that happen than going the whole rest of my life thinking, I wish I had tried it. I wish I could have done that. So and I know I've still got some healing to do and my memory's not there all the way and I have scar tissue, but I'm still doing everything I love doing, but I don't have the regret of trying it.
You know, there's some people listening and watching right now saying, is that guy nuts or what? And yet you just have this desire to push yourself to see kind of where the limits are. And I'm just wondering, not even wondering, it sounds to me like in that condition, because of your drive, you would have kept going had someone not intervened. And it's almost like God stepped in because he wanted to preserve you. It wasn't time to go yet. And I noticed that in some of the things I read about you that like when you're training for events and whatnot, whether it's biking or climbing or whatever it is, you like to pray. You like to pray during that time. Talk to us about that. Why do you pray? What do you pray? And what occurs as a result?
You know, Todd, I don't even do it consciously. I love long trail runs and long bike rides and long paddles where my mind just wanders. But when it wanders, where it wanders is praying for the people who need help. Beautiful. And I just, if I go on a 3-hour trail run, 2.5 hours of that are praying for people. And then powerful. I go, I got to pray for myself too. And then I forget about my, cause I got some things to pray for myself. Now that you know
us, we're expecting on one of these runs that you're going to be talking to God about us.
but what a great way to let your mind wander, you know, is in prayer and having conversation and listening to what the Lord has for you and just having that intimacy. I think that's beautiful. Yeah.
A nice prayer this morning. Just a nice prayer, just riding with some friends. I've always done that. I used to do it whenever I'd see water. When I'd see water, I'd stop and pray at the water. But now I just do it nonstop.
So how did your faith kind of shape up? As a child, you said that, you know, you were brought up God-fearing. And so what was your faith? What was the denomination you were brought up in? Kind of just what was your experience with the Lord as you first received Christ?
I'm Protestant and we belong to a church in Methuen, Mass. And unfortunately, the church spoiled me because there's an old, old stone church and beautiful stained glass and the organs in the back. And the minister was a good friend of ours and he'd come visit us on Sundays. And my father was a Sunday school teacher there. And it just was a big part of our lives. Mm. The minister's daughters were just friends. And I've never found anything since then. I got married in that church when I got a little older. My whole family went to that church. It was part of our life, a good part of our life. And I took it for granted, I think, because since I moved away, I've never found it since. But my parents used to have discussions. My father would say how important church is, and you have to support your church. Your church supports a community, and you have to go to the church to do your prayer and worship. My mother started getting sick, and she would cough a lot when she got sick, and she was embarrassed to go to church. So she wouldn't go because of that. She hated all the coughing she was doing. And so my mother and father always have discussions. My mother said, I can pray at the house. But we knew the reason she said that is because she didn't want to interrupt everybody in church. But my whole family is still, you know, we're all very close still. Three siblings I have, and we all feel the same about Christianity. And
beautiful,
church.
Beautiful, and awesome. And your faith is strong, and you talk to God, and you're not in a church building when you're talking to God, which is great. You have a relationship with God where, even when you're out running, training, whatever, you're able to talk with Him. I think that's a beautiful example about just, you know, not expecting that we have to be in a certain sort of religious place to talk with God. Don, there are a lot of people that want to, you know more about your career as a SEAL. Because anytime a SEAL is mentioned, people automatically go, oh my goodness, that's a different brand. That's a different breed of person.
Well, it is.
And it's true. But so what pulled you towards the Navy SEALs? And then let's talk a little bit about what happened during your experience. If you would just maybe kind of tell us how you got started there and why you ended up in the SEALs.
Okay. I knew I was going to serve the country somehow, somewhere. I mentioned my father and his family. But I tried going to college for a year right out of high school. And I was thinking, I can't do it another 3 years. I got to go in the military now. And my mother was so disappointed I wasn't going to be an officer. My father was so proud. But that's before I knew about the SEAL program. So I was going to go in the Marines thinking that would be a good, tough, physical thing to do. And when I went to the Marine recruiter, and I didn't know anything as a teenager, but I wasn't impressed by him for some reason. I went next door to the Navy recruiter, and Diamond Jim Brady was the recruiter. And he was so impressive, and he told me the truth, and he was likable. And he showed me a video, Men with Green Faces. And it showed all these guys running on the beach and shooting machine guns and skydiving and diving and going all over the world and considered the hardest training in the world, their training program, and the fittest military guys in the world. That movie changed my whole life. It's like, that's all I want to do. So when I talk to young people and people who want to become SEALs or Delta or Green Beret or something, I say, don't have a backup plan. Just go all the way toward what you want to do. Because when you're really being pushed hard and the instructors are yelling and screaming at you and you're in the ocean and you're hyping out with hypothermia, I mean, when it gets really, really bad, you're going to start looking at that backup plan as a better option. So don't have a backup plan.
That's good.
Good advice. Yeah.
And then, so going to SEAL training, I was positive I was going to make it. I was just positive. If I didn't, it was because I got hurt. Or the only hard times I had during the SEAL training was a cold water. And I was a really lean triathlete at the time, so I didn't have any body fat. And the cold water, I used to kind of hope I would pass out so they'd pull me out of there. But there was a
and
time.
And now people are doing cold plunges all the time. Like, that's intentional. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a time in the pool, and there was never a thought of quitting ever, because all I wanted was that. And I wasn't going to give up on that goal. But there was a time they say, okay, what you have to do a forward flip in the air, land in the pool, swim underwater to the other end, do a flip turn and come back, and don't give up. If you really think you need to breathe, exhale, but don't give up. You all have lung capacity to do that. So I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I trained so hard to be a SEAL. I couldn't train harder. I didn't know anybody who trained harder to be a SEAL.
And what kind of things, really quickly, did you do on your own to train to be a SEAL?
Well, I was training every day, push-ups, calisthenics, weights, long distance running, swimming. Everything I knew SEALs did, I did.
Okay.
To the extreme.
Made it your full-time job to train, yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And some workouts are eight hours long. Some days I would work out, my workout would start Friday afternoon and I'd work out till Monday morning without a break.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And push myself to hallucinations, passing out or bleeding.
Wow.
And I believe that if I wasn't pushing myself that hard where I'd hallucinate, pass out or bleed, I wasn't giving my all.
Okay. And so then when you're in the pool and you're doing this somersault, you know, swim and flip around. So did you withstand that test there or?
I failed.
Oh, you did?
I failed. I did my somersault, went across. I was coming back and my head was hurting from not breathing. It was 50 meters underwater. And all the things I trained, what I just mentioned, I never included holding my breath, doing breath holds, swims. And I didn't know that was going to be part of it, but I was going to do whatever, of course, whatever they said to do. But as my head was starting to hurt and I was coming up to the surface, I go, oh my God, I can't take it anymore. I can't take it anymore. And I came up and I quit. And they said, get over there, quitter. And me and all the other guys who quit, 8 of us out of the 120 or so quit. We didn't do it. And they were saying, these people, you don't want to waste your time with. They're quitters. I mean, they feel a little pain and they quit. You don't want to be associated with people like this. We're not going to waste our time with people like this here. And you start feeling really, really small. Mm. And then finally they'd say, okay, you want to give these guys another chance?
Like to phone a friend, Wim Hof.
Yeah, yeah. I actually endorsed his book.
Ah, very good.
Yeah.
The Iceman.
Yeah. I never met him.
That's cool.
But
well, he's probably saying I never got a chance to meet Don.
Right.
That's what he's saying.
That's it.
But what happened years later, I went back in the pool and made it that time. Mm. And I passed out, shallow water blackout, and they pulled you out and you're frothing at the mouth. But at least you pass, you know. But then years later, we were under a ship doing a ship attack. It was a hostage rescue. And it was in the middle of the night and you're breathing oxygen for 4 hours, which becomes toxic if it's over 4 hours, 100% oxygen. Mm. So you're diving, all of you on a dive pole, and you finally find the ship and you hook up a line underneath the ship. It's all pitch black. And you find this line, you take off your fins and you hook them in, you take your weight belt off, hook it in. And then you're just waiting for the signal, toot, 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 so you can hear it underwater. Then everybody surfaces. And then you climb the ladder, you hook up to the side of the ship, and then you take over the ship. But while I was underwater, our dive went over 4 hours. And I was the medic, so I was looking, you can't see anything. So you're looking at your watch thinking, oh my God, it's over 4 hours. People are going to start convulsing and passing out. And so I couldn't wait. It was a bad dive. A lot of things were going wrong. Hmm. And finally, I was just waiting there and had all my gear off. And then my oxygen froze up. I couldn't breathe. I was like, and I was under the ship. It wasn't in some pool in Coronado, San Diego, and I couldn't breathe. So I went through my safety SOP, standard operating procedures. My mouthpiece was on. I checked it. The hoses weren't kinked and the oxygen was on. I went through those procedures 3 times. And then I shook my buddy's fin above me and he came down. I just did this to his mouth to see if he had a mouthpiece in so I could buddy breathe with him. And he didn't. So I went through my procedures again. And now my head was starting to hurt as bad as it did in the pool that day. Mm. But it's pitch black. And they said, whatever you do, don't give yourself away under a ship. The enemy will throw grenades in there. And this was a training mission. But that's how we believe. The enemy throws grenades in there. Everyone's killed. So if one person blows the mission, you're killing your whole team. Mm. And so we can't do anything to disrupt that mission. So, but my head was killing me. And I was thinking, I'm going to have to surface. So I swam up to the bottom of the ship. And I felt the bottom and I was walking. And if a ship is, you know, this big, I could see it on camera. You're only like so small that you don't really know where you are on that ship. And I was coming upside the side of the ship and I couldn't wait to take a breath. And now it just felt like a knife going in and out of my skull. It hurt so badly. And I couldn't surface because there was some big obstruction. And then I was thinking, well, I'll do what they taught me to do in BUDS. I'll just keep kicking and not quit. Kick and kick and kick. But I was going deeper and it was cold and it was getting colder and colder and colder. But somehow I managed to swim underwater, and minutes had gone by without breathing. I don't know how many minutes, but a lot of minutes, just to swim all the way to the front of the ship underwater. And then I came up to the port side, and the ladder was there, and my buddies had already climbed it. I climbed up the ladder, and we took over the ship, and it was a mission success. And it was just by not quitting. And I know if I hadn't had that good training in BUDS, there were two times I was thinking, wow, I could get rid of this pain. All I have to do is take one deep breath and I'll drown myself. And and then I was thinking, they'd never find my body under the ship. And I wish I never had that thought, because that's how a quitter thinks. But I did quit in BUDS, but that lesson lasted me a lifetime. I never quit after that.
Wow.
God's hand is on you.
I think it's really, it's amazing, and it's a great lesson and a great challenge for us to have in your mind a mindset that says, I'm never going to quit. I'm going to get through this. And I think that there are so many little challenges in life that we quit so quickly and so easily.
Yeah.
But your training and your mindset allowed you to get through death-defying circumstances. And thinking about, you know, we could spend hours with you, Don, just hearing story after story about all these covert operations you were involved in with SEAL Team 1, and then over to SEAL Team 2. And then we heard your story about how you got into SEAL Team 6, which is another whole level up of...
But our listeners haven't heard it.
No, that's true. So, they have not heard it. So
maybe you want to share a little bit about that.
Yeah.
On getting to SEAL Team 6?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, when SEAL Team 6 first started, excuse me, Richard Marcinko created it, and he wanted a counter-terrorist maritime unit. We already had SEALs. We had SEAL Team 1 and SEAL Team 2, and then we had underwater demolition teams which were converted to SEALs. So we had SEAL teams on the West Coast, the odd numbers, 1, 3, and 5, and on the East Coast, we had teams 2, 4, and 8. But when SEAL Team 6 was created, all we had was 1 and 2. So that was created in 1980, and Richard Marcinko wanted to confuse the Russians. We had a SEAL Team 1, a SEAL Team 2. Let's create a SEAL Team 6. Yeah, we'll just pick 6.
That's wild.
But now we have 10 teams. But back then, it was just to confuse the Russians, who were following us everywhere we went during the Cold War years. And but SEAL Team 6 was different, because all the West Coast teams, so odd numbers, 1, 3, and 5, and now 7, They cover the west side of the world, the Pacific side of the world. And the East Coast teams, 2, 4, 8, and 10 now, they were covering Europe, Central, and South America. But SEAL Team 6 had a worldwide capability, so it was different. So when you have a worldwide capability, now it's not like if you're at SEAL Team 4 back in those days, you had to just be really, really good at jungle ops, Central South America. If you're on the West Coast, SEAL Teams 1, 3, or 5, you had to be really good in the desert, desert ops. And but now to have a worldwide capability, you had to be good in the jungle, urban warfare, Arctic warfare, desert warfare. And you had the training that was funded with no limit. So you got the best training in the world, but you had a four-hour recall. So when your beeper went off, when you got recalled, you had to get to work quickly, find out where in the world this mission's going to take place, pack your bags, and get it on a flight. And that flight has to be wheels up within 4 hours. So the other teams didn't have that. They would say, hey, we're going to deploy. We're going to go to the Philippines. We're going to go to somewhere, Italy or somewhere, and we're going to be there for 6 months. And if something happens, we will go to the mission in that area of operation from that location. But SEAL Team 6 was different. SEAL Team 6 is beeper goes off and you're flying right to that spot. So everything was different and everything was more dangerous and everything was more realistic in the training. But they weren't used that much initially. It was kind of like the president's private team. Where if something really bad had happened, you know, the SEAL Team 6 was, they were selecting a lot of the good guys from the other teams just to get there. So they're already really well-trained. Then you get to 6 and then you get more training. So they were kind of like a secret little entity. When I first saw Team 6, even guys in the teams, we didn't hear too much about what they were doing. They were that secretive. But you saw them, they had longer hair and beards, and they didn't look like the military at all, which was the point. And I, when I found out about SEAL Team 6, I said, who would not want to be part of SEAL Team 6?
Of course, so cool. Of course you said that.
Why not go all the way?
Yeah.
And so I went there twice. I went there as an enlisted man, uh-huh. and then I got commissioned as a warrant officer. Then went back as a warrant officer, and I retired from there.
Amazing. Well, there's so many stories that you know have been shared about SEAL Team 6, and I'm sure many, many stories that can never be shared just because of the security issues. But, you know, here you are on SEAL Team 6, and you help train, I understand, members of SEAL Team 6 in a number of those missions. So, you know, again, we could stay here for hours hearing so many stories, but I think underlying all those stories is the Don man who does not give up, who sets macro goals and then micro goals to get there.
And is a great leader.
And nothing seems to stop you or you know, change your focus. You just stay very focused on things. And I'm assuming, Don, that because you've had all those experiences and you've had to persevere and you've understood pain, that when it comes to your personal life, you're able to pull all of these same kinds of principles and tactics, if you will, into your personal life. Because we talked a little bit before we got recording here, but so I understand there's been some personal family loss and even a recent diagnosis of cancer. So can you talk to us a little bit about how you're going through these things and how you've developed that inner strength to keep pushing forward?
Yep. You know, of course, Todd, I do think that training and experiences of being strong when I had to be strong helps, because now my daughter, who lives in Panama, she's got a four-year-old daughter, who's my granddaughter, who's got leukemia. And this morning at 4 o'clock, my daughter texted me. I'm going to go see her Sunday, so in a couple of days. Okay. And then she said, oh, my God, poor little Azalea. She's throwing up. I can't take it anymore. I can't take it. So I have to be really strong to give my daughter strength to be strong for my granddaughter. Right. So that's an example.
Yeah. Well, right, real quick, that's just such a reminder of how, you know, our strength can create a ripple effect for others so that they can be encouraged and survive a situation. So I think that's beautiful. But
go ahead.
No, I agree with Wendy too. Mm-hmm. Wendy, I think that we all have strengths and weaknesses, but if we can share our strengths with people when they need them, I think that's why we're here.
Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah.
You know, we need help too. All of us.
Yeah. Amen.
I love the fact that you are so motivated and willing to help others get through their situation. So you've written 22 books. They're all help books on a whole variety of subjects, and then decided, you know, or I guess someone decided for you, because this is the way God works with you, that you're going to do TV series.
Yeah, create them, and be a host. Yeah.
All these things that you created, and look, he's just a humble guy, but but there's, for the benefit of others, to inspire, to motivate, to encourage. I mean, we'd watched a couple of the shows just last night in prep, and like, I'm all charged up, ready to go. I'll get down on the floor and do these push-ups right now. That guy did 100, I'll do 105. So you're always motivated. But tell us a little bit about these TV shows that have been created and what you're intending for those.
You know, for Surviving Man, I think the ones that you watch, that wasn't my idea at all. And a friend, Bob Seafell, he always said to me, because he used to do, he had a product endorsement company, and I did some product endorsements for him years ago. He said, someday I'm going to create a TV show and I want you to host it and just teach people to shoot and exercise and stuff like that. I said, sure, Bob. He said that every year. I said, yeah, sure, Bob. Sure. I never thought it would happen, but it was all his idea. But it's doing well. And then Surviving Man, shout out to Surviving Man, Surviving Man All-Stars, and Surviving Man The Aftermath. And then this last one we just did a couple weeks ago, we have an event called Face Off, where you sprint up to a sniper weapon, take the shot, then you go in this snake-infested water, do a low crawl for 200 meters, as I'm telling them, watch out for the rattlesnakes, just to stir them up a bit. And then bear crawl up a hill, crab crawl down the hill, sprint up the hill, and then they go through this ravine where they have a lot of 10 obstacles crawling and sliding over these obstacles. And then they have 10 shotgun, pistol, and long gun shots to take. And then a 2-mile run around the lake. And it's called Face Off. And it's going to be another TV show. So it just started out with Bob's idea, Surviving Man. And then all these other shows are developing after it. And then Richard Marcinko, who created SEAL Team 6, he was helping out with a movie called American Smuggler. And Richard Marcinko passed away. So then I was asked by the movie producer if I would take his spot. I said, well, those are some huge shoes to fill, but I'll do my best. It'll be an honor. So I've been working on that for a year and a half without a contract, just because it's an honor to do it. But now it looks like there's a contract coming. But that movie's going to happen, and it's going after, you know, the chase of El Chapo. But mainly the movie creator, he wants to really highlight what it's done to women and children, the exploitation of women and children, and not so much El Chapo itself, but just he was standing on a grave with 30 bodies of children when a tunnel collapsed, and that really hit him hard. Mm-hmm. And so that's why he wants this movie done.
Well, and I think that that's good, because I don't think people are as aware of what's going on in this world as we could and should be, and how we can play a role and be a part of being the solution, right? Instead of sticking our head in the sand, we need to be aware, we need to know, and we need to step up. And even when it's maybe a little painful and a little uncomfortable for us to do so, it's our duty as humanity, you know, we're to be a tribe and to help one another. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking about these shows that you've been involved in, and maybe others that you're not aware of yet that God's still going to bring your way. You know, they always involve, you know, challenges and risks that have to be taken and pain that has to be endured and experienced. And I'm thinking that there's an agenda that you're after when you do these shows. So what is it that you really want viewers to take away, and all these different shows that they watch and the movies that are coming? What's your hope for viewers?
I think I have two agendas, and I like to, all these years people say, hey, what makes a person want to be a SEAL? How do you go climb a mountain? And how do I train to be a firefighter or something? So I just try to mumble my way through advice, and I really never really had it down until I broke it down into just, all you have to do is four things in life. And these four things, if it's something physical you want to do, like we'll say as an example, to be a SEAL, all you have to do is four things. That's all, just four things.
Wait a minute, we got to take notes on this one. All right, number one.
is just do something every day that makes you stronger. Every day, do something that makes yourself. That could be CrossFit, that could be the gym, could be Pilates, could be yoga. But every day, you plan. But you just have to do every day, do something to make yourself stronger. It's number one. Mm. And every day, do something to make yourself faster. If you want to be a SEAL, you have to be a runner. So hill sprints, fartleks. If you can do 120 sit-ups in 2 minutes, do 130 in 2 minutes. Sprints in the pool, but every day do something to make yourself stronger. Every day do something to make yourself faster. And then if it is a SEAL you want to be, then every day get smarter. Learn about what they were doing in Vietnam and what the early frogmen were doing in World War II and Korea. And now the 90 country SEALs are operating, and learn this chute and go skydive, take a skydiving course, learn to dive and do all that stuff, and learn to be, learn about SEALs, be smarter in that. But, and then most importantly, number four is every day do something good for somebody. That could be your neighbor, your mother, your girlfriend, your wife, your boyfriend, your husband, but the man across the street who can't get those leaves in the garbage can, just go help him. Yes. And if you do this at 12, if you started this at 12 years old or 14 or 15, when you go to selection of whatever it is you want to be, you just might be the strongest there. You might be the fastest, you might be the smartest, but you're going to be the teammate everybody wants because you're so used to helping people. And then sometimes, like talking with bankers or medical communities or people who aren't into the physical fitness, I said, well, you could still use those four things. Instead of getting stronger every day, be a stronger leader. And you don't have to be at the top of the chain to be a strong leader. You're what, how you inspire people and the way you act and behave, you can influence more people by being stronger. That's and good. Being faster, just be more efficient. You know, maybe it's not physical speed, but you can be more efficient at what you do. So you have more time with your family. And smarter, yeah, we all get smarter on everything and always help people. And so that's one aspect. And the other aspect, I just love what sports and push myself have done to me. And I love passing that on. So creating real challenges to people that they get that same feeling I've had all my life. Like, wow, that was so hard. I didn't think I could do it. I'm so glad I did it.
Yeah.
And then they do it. Those are the two things that push me, I guess.
Oh, that's incredible. So
good. Stronger,
good.
Faster, smarter, and do something
people.
Good for someone.
Yes,
that's
yes.
So good.
I love that. That's something that everyone can take from this podcast for sure and implement. You know, what if there is someone listening to this podcast that's just really feeling stuck, purposeless? Purposeless? Purposeless. They're just feeling in a funk. Like what you said is like, yeah, sure, Don, that sounds great. Yeah, I'll get stronger. I'll get fat. I mean, they're just not in that space, that headspace. What would you say to them to help them get into that headspace in order to start taking action and doing things differently, to feeling better and knowing their purpose?
Well, unfortunately for everybody on this planet, life goes up and down, up and down, up and down. We all end up in the low parts in our lives and high part. It's going to end. That low period's going to end at some point. Mm-hmm. And you can't give up. You just can't give up. Mm-hmm. You just have to have the faith that things are going to get better, and you can help make things better too. I mean, don't just sit back and think when things are going to get better.
That's good.
Even if you go out and just go help some people, you're going to feel better about yourself.
That's right.
Amen. Preach it. Yep.
Yeah. That alone will help them feel better.
That's good.
I took a friend of mine had a nephew who became a heroin addict. And he went to a rehab place in Colorado. And the family called me and they said, oh, poor Ian, he's a heroin addict and he's stealing from the family. He's doing all these terrible things. His life has gone down to rock bottom. I said, is there anything that you would suggest? I said, I'll come out to Denver, and I arranged this through the rehab center. I did a talk at the rehab center, and I said, let me take Ian out to a mountain. There's 54 14,000 footers out there. And here I am, 65 or something, and he's like 18 and fit and muscular and everything. And I said, Ian, I'm not going to talk about drugs and all that, but let's just go. We'll camp out the night before, and we'll just hike up the trail. We'll do a 14,000 footer. There's 54 14,000 footers in Colorado.
Yeah.
And it's dark when we start, but once you get up and the sun starts coming up and you start seeing the other peaks above the clouds, you're going to feel different about yourself. And once we summit, because you're going to summit, you're going to see the world differently. And he was kind of quiet, and we got to the top. And then at the top, I said, Ian, you know, I don't really like walking down. You know, you have gravity to help. Let's run down. And he said, oh, okay. So we ran down. And I said, Ian, you did so well. I am so happy with what we did. We have time today to go do another one. And he was quiet. I said, let's go do another one. So we did another 14,000 footer. And he came down.
Oh, my goodness.
So a lot of times people won't do two in one day.
No.
A lot of times people won't do one in one day. Yeah, right.
And then that night he was exhausted. I said, Ian, you know, I can't believe what you just did, but I have you all weekend. Let's do another one tomorrow morning. And he didn't want to say no. I said, you know, and I kept saying, I'm an old guy. You know, if you want to go ahead of me, do it. So then we did a third one and he got quieter and quieter. And of course we ran down every one of them. I said, Ian, I've never been with anybody who's done four of these in a weekend. But mm-hmm. You have it in you. Let's just go do another one. So then he came back and they said, did you make it to the top? He said, I made four summits. I made it four times. And he sees the world differently now. Then he went to mountaineering school and he became a mountain paramedic.
Oh, my gosh. I love this.
And he just had time. You know, I do my prayers during these times. But during that, you know, 10, 12-hour periods, he was able to reflect and then see the world and see peaks coming up above the clouds. He just saw himself differently than someone in some urban setting putting a needle in his arm.
Yeah. Beautiful. Being that close to
goodness.
God.
That is so good. That's such an inspiring story because, again, it's applicable. Whatever it is that you're facing that seems like the big mountain in front of you, just go get it.
Attack it.
Get to the top of it. Summit it. And that can literally apply to anything and everything we're going through. But love that kind of a strategy, and look how far it went. Don, as we start to bring things to a close here, we have to ask you this question, and that is, with all of the experiences of life up to this point, and who knows what God has in store for you next, But you've had so many breakthroughs.
I think you're just getting started.
I know, seriously. You've had so many breakthroughs in so many different areas. Is there any one breakthrough that kind of stands out for you as one that was maybe pivotal in your life?
I would say losing loved ones, you know, when you see how fragile life is and people could be killed or shot or die of some disease. And, you know, one day they're with you and the next they're not, just how fragile and precious life is. And once you really understand that, you might stop taking life for granted and you have to make the best of it. And make the best of it for other people too. You know, do things that help other people because you're not going to be around forever. Leave them with good memories and they're not going to be around forever, but make what they have left, you know, meaningful. I think the breakthrough for me was losing close friends or family people and realizing, boy, I wish I had more time with that person. Folks I've known a lot who've committed suicide recently. I wish I was there. I wish I could have talked to them. I mean, I think I could have helped them. And all the people you wish you could have helped that you didn't, and they pass, you know, that weighs on you. So if you don't let that happen, and anytime you see a friend or family member in need of anything, just to be there for them. Yeah. That was a breakthrough when I realized that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a breakthrough because I did that. It's just I realized I wish I had done something more.
That's good. Yeah,
that's good. And that is important. And it's just a reminder that no matter what that person may be saying, because maybe the individuals in your life were saying they're fine or that no, I don't need anything or whatever. Sometimes we just need to go and sit with those people. We don't have to say anything. Just like with the friend's nephew that you worked with, you didn't talk to him about drugs. You just
spent time
with him. And he got to hear from God himself and have the revelation and see the world differently. And so, life is meant to be lived and lived well. And it is an adventure, but we're to do it alongside others and help others up those mountains, and down them. So thank you for who you are. Thank you for just the way you live life, the way you think about life, the way you think about others, and your pitbull tenacity. Like you just go after it and attack it. And it's very encouraging for all of us. So how would someone follow you, reach out to you? How would someone get in touch with you or just see the work you're doing?
I guess through a website, and it's usfrogman.com. Mm-hmm. And that's what they used to call SEALs, Frogman. But I use Frogman with my last name. So it's usfrogman.com.
Perfect.
That's good. And we'll put that in the show notes too. And so if somebody says, oh man, those shows that he's doing, how do I apply to get on that show?
Wait, are you saying you're going to apply?
I don't know if you got one for senior citizens. I might think about it.
You don't look like a senior citizen at all. You're not, I know. But that website, there's a link to the shows and they can apply to that. Oh,
that's so good. Don, you are an incredible inspiration. We love you. We love what you stand for. We love what you've done. We love what you're doing. We love what God has planned for you and all the lives you touch. And thank you for challenging us to really reach out and make a difference in the lives of others. And on the way to, you know, take seriously the disciplines of becoming stronger and faster and smarter and doing something good for someone else. So bless you, my friend. We really appreciate
you. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. Thank you, Todd. I really appreciate getting to know you. Thank you. And for all you do.
Thank you.
Well, that's a wrap for today's show. We hope you enjoyed it. As always, we love spending time with you right here on Your Biggest Breakthrough podcast. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode. But until then, just head on over to yourbiggestbreakthrough.com where you'll find some free resources and information and a place where you can comment, and we would love to dialogue with you there. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.